The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. I'm going to run through the announcements because our guests may only be with us for the first hour. We're playing it by ear. Homer Hickam is with us. He's actually at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center at the Great Moon Buggy Race, and we'll get him to talk a little bit about that. And he's there, and his time may be short upon us. So briefly, if you want to call us, it is 1-866-687-7223. If you want to email us, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then also do remember that we are archived, and you're free to download these shows and share them and pass them around. Just don't do anything commercial, no edits, no YouTube channels, and no written transcripts, please. And then do also remember that we're brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. And you can get a lot more information about Secure World at their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And I want to jump right in with Homer Hickam. And so Homer has been a coal miner. He was a Vietnam combat vet, a scuba instructor. He's been a NASA engineer, and now he is, of course, a best-selling author. Many of you will certainly know of him through Rocket Boys and the movie and possibly the musical, if you were able to see that musical. And he has written many, many other books since then. And he has a new book that is out as of April called Crater, and this is a Helium 3 trilogy book. This is the first of this trilogy. Crater is the name of a young teenager living on the moon. It's not it's not about a crater on the moon. And Homer's bio is up on the website already, and you'll be able to read about him. Welcome back to the program, Homer. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you for having me. It's where I am right now is a lot of excited people about space at the Great Moon Buggy Race, and one of the things I get to do is tell these young people that I've actually got a moon buggy race in the novel Crater. The difference being they're in 1/6 gravity versus our 1G here, and man, that makes a lot of difference. When you hit a bump here, you just kind of bump. On the moon, you hit a bump, and you're going to go flying.
Absolutely. Are there a lot of people there, a lot of kids there, participants?
Yeah, they've got, I don't know how many foreign countries are here, besides, of course, the United States. There's like 50 teams here, and the deal is that they essentially have to fit a human-powered buggy carrying two people within a small size and then unfold it and then go across a series of obstacles. And as they do that, they have to, of course, it's also a time thing, and it's very interesting seeing some of these different designs, and also seeing some of them kind of fall apart when they hit the obstacles. That's not funny for the teams, but it can be kind of amusing for us who like that kind of thing.
Let's jump ahead to, well, what's the people are really enthusiastic. Is it kids? You're talking about young adults, college students, or old geezers, or everybody?
No, we're not allowing any old geezers to do this. It's mostly high school and college kids, and they have the two divisions of high school and college. And last year, a high school from Puerto Rico won, and the team from Germany, I believe, the college team won. So, like I said, it's an international competition, and this year it looks like all these teams have really, really stepped up. It's kind of fun to see I've got a couple of talks I'm giving to folks here, talking about Crater and talking about the moon and talking about some of that stuff. And then, when I get a chance, I run out and watch the moon buggy race, and it's just a lot of fun.
Well, Crater takes place in the 22nd century, so we've got time to get our act together to get a moon colony going.
Well, the way I see it and the way that I write Crater is that most likely when we get serious about going back to the moon and actually living there, it'll be because entrepreneurs see a way of making some money there. And the reason that this is the first in the Helium 3 series is because Crater lives in a mining town, and that mining town is organized very much like the mining town where I grew up that, you know, I wrote about in Rocket Boys and was in the movie October Sky. And so I've got some expertise there. And that's what I see is that once we figure out how to make some money up there, and Helium 3 is the obvious way because Helium 3 saturates the regolith of the moon, and it's an isotope of the sun that doesn't, not much of it reaches the Earth because of our atmospheric magnetic field, but it covers airless orbs in the solar system, and especially the moon. And helium-3, it turns out, is the perfect fuel for fusion reactors. Now, we have a serious shortage of fusion reactors, but if we're serious about green energy, eventually we will build them. It'll be unlimited energy, and it's clean energy. And so Crater lives in a helium-3 mining town. It's a very rough town. It's like the Wild West on the moon. The miners are there. A lot of them are ex-convicts, and they're just trying to run away from what's on Earth. And they come to the moon and live in this very dangerous place. But Crater doesn't know any different. He's an orphan. He was born there, and he's lived there his whole life.
And is the helium-3 it's being mined to be sent back to Earth or to be used in space or both of the above?
Primarily to be sent to Earth, which is desperate for energy for a variety of different reasons, as I see in the future, where a lot of technologies have failed and they are desperate for a major driver of energy like fusion. Now, it was interesting when I started researching the book. I thought, well, I'll go out there and I'll find some place book that'll tell me how to mine helium-3 on the moon. Well, it turned out there really wasn't any. There are some that kind of alluded to it and had a few little things, but there really wasn't. Nobody had ever really come up with a way of how you would actually mine this stuff. So as part of the background for Crater, I figured it out. I have a mining engineering background, and it's surface mining. And what would you actually have to do to mine all the? You're going to have to move a lot of millions of tons of dust, and basically all that dust has to be moved and carry it to shakers and probably solar heaters to get the helium-3 out, have to be compressed in tanks, and then those tanks have to be transported eventually to Earth. And one of the things that happens to Crater is that he's sent across on a helium-3 convoy 1,000 miles to Armstrong City, which is the main settlement there. And along the way, a lot of people try to kill him. He can't figure out why, and so it hangs the tail. But all of that has to be carried, the helium-3 has to be carried to Earth. And the way I see that happening is a lunar elevator, which is a very feasible concept for the moon. It's hard on Earth, but it's a lot easier on the moon. And then the cycler, which is what I think NASA should be doing next, is building a cycler. And that is essentially a ship that constantly orbits the moon and the Earth. And all you have to do on Earth is fly up to the cycler and hook on, and you got your ride.
So you see NASA's role as a cycler, which is sort of a perpetual endless loop transportation system to and from the moon, but the privates are going to go and mine it, figure out how to bring it back and do all of this economically, correct?
Well, what I think that's what NASA ought to do is to prove the concept that a cycler works, but ultimately I see a private company. It's just like when we built the Transcontinental Railroad. Federal government got very involved with that and basically paid private companies to build that railroad, and then the private companies took over after that. So I'd like to see that kind of cooperation between the federal government and commercial companies to build cyclers But of course, you really, in order for this to work, you've got to have a reason to have cyclers and to be carrying humans and payloads back and forth between the moon and the Earth. And one of those things, I think, very definitely in the future will be helium-3. There's also a lot of other minerals on the moon, like titanium, that would be probably commercially viable to bring back and forth. But what we have to do is to figure out how to make all of this as inexpensive, cheap as possible. And what I really like is what Elon Musk is doing with SpaceX and some of the other companies about low Earth orbit. And I think that NASA should be focusing on how to get us back and forth to the moon cheaply, and also how to get up into low Earth orbit. And I've been recommending that NASA really, really push scramjets. Scramjet, single-stage orbit, takeoff from a runway with a scramjet to the high atmosphere and a little rocket boost in orbit, and that's a really cheap way to go.
Do we have we don't have fusion yet. Are you optimistic that we will actually have commercial break-even fusion reactors that would be able to use the HE3? Because we seem to pour a lot of money into, like, ITER over there in Europe, and it doesn't go anyplace.
Yeah, the problem is the reason that it doesn't go anyplace is because we're doing everything sequentially. In other words, they will try this way, the one that you just named that I forgot now. But the Russians try away, and then the Japanese try away, and they make them work, but they make the fusion reactors work, but they end up putting more energy into them than they get out of them. But I think it's like building the first atomic bomb. When we need fusion reactors, what we will do is we will we'll have a crash program, and we'll build five or six fusion reactors at different variations, and then we'll choose the one that works the best, and we'll perfect that. So it really is all a matter of, do you really need it? Right now, we don't need a fusion reactor because fossil fuels are still very, very cheap. There's enough natural gas in West Virginia for like 200 years of energy for the United States if they let us go get it, and it's clean burning. So right now there's no really requirement for to put the money and the time and the effort to create the fusion reactors. But eventually that will happen. I have no doubt that it will, for a variety of different reasons, because it is perfect, really the perfect energy producer with no pollution on the other end. And when that happens, we'll start to seriously go back to the moon.
Now, going back to your book, Crater has a pal that's kind of an unusual pal, to say the least, that you created. kind of a slime pal, is that a way to describe it?
Well, the ghillie is made out of slime mold cells, and slime mold cells are very, very interesting. It sounds awful, but if you go read up on slime mold cells, they seem to have an intelligence that it's really beyond what you think that these little cells should have. They're able to gather and organize themselves. They can even make what appear to be feet and legs and walk around. And what I see, the next big revolution that's coming, technically, is going to be the biological revolution. And so, why build a computer out of aluminum and silicon and this kind of thing when you can just build one out of slime mold cells that will live as long as you want it to live and to do a variety of different things? So the ghillie, Crater has a ghillie, is what it's called. It's a little clump of slime mold cells that lives on his shoulder or in a holster. It's actually illegal. Earth declared them illegal some years ago, and people are always telling Crater, you know, your ghillie's illegal, and he says, well, it knows that, and that's kind of a running joke. But the ghillie helps Crater through all kinds of problems, and I think most kids would just love to have a ghillie on their shoulder.
So this is a three-part novel series, and this is your first part. Your next part goes out next year, and then I guess the year after, correct?
Right, yeah. We're going to go out the 1, 2, 3 sequence. I look forward to the day when you can actually go out and buy the whole set of the Helium-3 series. In this one, we are introduced to Crater and his ghillie and his possible girlfriend, Maria, and his brother, Petro. And the basic device on this is that, or plot, is that Crater is a young man who, like a lot of teen boys, is very unsure of himself. He doubts himself. He doubts how smart he is, and and if he has any courage. And he does something very, very brave out on the scrapes, and the owner of the mine notices that and decides that since Prater is such an innocent that nobody would suspect him of going off and getting a very important artifact for the colonel. So he makes him a scout on a convoy, and they go across 1,000 miles of the moon, and there's a lot of things happen to Crater, and it seems like everybody's trying to kill him, and he doesn't know why. And eventually he vaults into space and ends up on a cycler. And so it's, my hope is that it'll get boys and girls interested in reading and interested in the moon and interested in all the possibilities of space.
Now, Crater was born on the moon, correct? He didn't come there from Earth. This is his natural
right.
home.
He is an orphan, and what happened was that his parents were killed in the landing on the moon before the lunar elevator was built, and he was born as his mom is dying. He's born in the little clinic there at Armstrong City. And the way it is on the moon, there's no real law there, and there's no government or anything. And so the nurses just hand the baby over to a couple who wanted a baby, and they were headed up to the 1,000 miles across the moon to go to live in Moontown and work as helium-3 miners. And along the way, they don't know what to name the baby, and they see so many craters that it ends up to being his name. That's why he's named Crater.
Do you think that what's the age group? Let me go that way. How young a kid could pick up your book and read it? Is this for real young people or teens and higher?
Yeah, it's really, I would say, from 11 to 99 or 111. it is a young adult novel. If they can read Harry Potter, if they can read Hunger Games, they can certainly read Crater, but you know, adults will like this this book too. It's not, you know, my feeling for it is that the young adult genre is one that a lot of adults love, and they show it by reading the Harry Potter books and the Hunger Games books. And so, I didn't try to write it down to any level or anything. Mainly, it's the protagonists have to be teenagers. But otherwise, it's just a Homer Hickam book.
How big is Armstrong City?
Armstrong City has about 5,000 people who live in it, and they're primarily merchants and then involved with the distribution of helium-3. They also receive tourists as they come in. The Apollo 11 landing site is only a couple of miles away, and it's now a major tourist attraction, so they've got little trolleys that run out to the Apollo 11 moon, landing site, and that was one of the things that was really, really fun to imagine what that would be like and how that site would look with tourists coming to see it, and how it would be protected, and what the tour bus tour guide would say. Of course, 120 years in the future, they're liable to get a lot of it wrong. And so that was kind of fun, and just trying to protect it. And I say that the Chinese landed a rover there and knocked the flag down, and they had to put it back up. And it's just a lot of fun to imagine what might happen when that Apollo 11 landing site is just another tourist attraction.
You got an email question from Carl, who's listening in Tucson, Arizona, and he said, in order for Crater and others to be successfully living and working on the moon, how did you solve radiation and lunar dust problems?
Well, lunar dust is the big, big problem for if you're going to work out on the moon, because that is really, really nasty stuff. It's kind of like ground-up glass. It's not smooth like dust here on the Earth. It's very, very jagged if you look at it under a microscope. So one of Crater's jobs, actually his job out there on the straits, is what's called a belt picker. And his job is to go around with a tool like a pry bar and pry out all the rocks and try to clean out all the dust from the conveyor belts and also from the scraping machines that are out there and the haulers and the loaders and so on. So that is a big, big problem. In terms of radiation, the people live underground. They live 20 feet underground in tubes. They're called living tubes, and they're made out of mooncrete. Mooncrete has already been shown to be viable to, and it turns out there's a lot more water on the moon than we ever thought. So a little bit of water and a little bit of moon dust, you can make some really, really sturdy structures out of this, out of mooncrete. Now, the miners outside in the vacuum do not wear the old Apollo-style pressure suits. They wear what I call bioelastic suits, which is cellular suits. Again, I think the revolution is going to be in biology. And what I see is that they simply put on a sheath of cells that are designed to put the equivalent of one atmosphere of pressure on the workers outside, and then they can just wear coveralls and boots. They still have to wear a helmet. It's really, really hard to get away from a helmet. But everything else is going to be a lot, lot different after this biological revolution.
So they carry their oxygen supply on the back like a scuba tank?
Well, they carry a backpack, but in there they've got a biological suit that produces the equivalent of air. And I get away from them breathing pure oxygen. I get away from them having to go through all kinds of depressurization by simply having this biosuit create 80% nitrogen, 20% oxygen, and at one atmosphere. So that makes it a lot easier going in and out. You don't have to worry about decompression like scuba divers. And that's why the Apollo astronauts breathe pure oxygen at 5 psi. But then if you want to come back to normal atmosphere and avoid all the possible explosive possibilities of pure oxygen, the best thing to do is to go to an Earthian-like atmosphere. So you see, David, in order to, and this is all background, of course, to get a story of Crater, but I have to figure all that out, I have to make it really realistic and for the reader to believe in it.
So actually, for the readers and for people listening to the show, they get a real engineering potential here on how these problems can be solved into the future.
Yeah, and I really had to give it a lot of thought. You know, generally my books are all character-driven. I say what people are really interested in is other people. So I do want, and I did make Crater and Petro and Maria and Nagili and all that the interesting characters, but in order to make this truly believable, I had to figure out a lot of new stuff, and that was a lot of fun to sit down. And of course, I did my research, and I'm going, okay, how did other people say we're going to live on the moon? And I find out, well, there's not much out there. So basically, okay, Homer, you're an engineer, you're a mining engineer, and you're an aerospace engineer, and you've got a background in industrial engineering as well. Sit down and figure it out. How would you do it if it was handed to you? How would you live on the moon, and how would you do it? It turned out, I'd almost forgotten that I had done a study of what it would take to live on the moon back in the early 1990s. I actually, if people want to go to my website, homerhickam.com, and click on where it says newsletters or the blog, what will come up is our newsletter that also includes, they go down about three newsletters, they'll see that study that I did on how to actually build structures that live on the moon.
Here's another one that maybe you figured out. This is from Harriet, and Harriet is in Seattle, Washington, and said, if Armstrong City has about 5,000 people in it, is it growing only because more people come up there from Earth, or are actually children being born there? And how did you figure out pregnancy and birth and kids growing up in a microgravity environment?
Now, that's a good question. It's a little bit of one, a little bit of the other. What I predict, or the background for Crater, is that there's a lot of trouble on the Earth. There's a lot of wars, a lot of starvation, a lot of battles.
Well, it doesn't take much to predict that, does it? I mean, that seems to be our norm here on Earth.
Well, it does, but now they've got a place to go. They can escape to the moon, which is up till now has been very, very peaceful. So we have a lot of people who have had a lot of trouble on the Earth, and they're escaping from it, who are coming to live on the moon and work on the scrapes or work in Armstrong City. But babies are being born there, and the population is growing. So how do we do that? First place, I've got a little bit of background in in life sciences with NASA. I was the training manager on the frog embryology experiment, which we studied very, very closely on cellular development and fertilization of eggs in a microgravity environment. So I've got a little bit of background there. But also, I know that to live in a microgravity environment is very hard on the heart and the muscles because they both tend to deteriorate in that case. So everything on the moon is moon-type, and that means that it's six times heavier than it needs to be. Even the knife, fork, and spoon you pick up is made of a very dense material that weighs six times more. Everything is hard there. All the hatches are spring-loaded. Nothing just swings open easily. You've got to push on everything to make it move. And so there's this constant work that has to be done to live on the moon. And I believe is that'll help keep the heart healthy and the muscles growing.
So everything is resistance oriented, and to do anything, you're sort of doing isometric exercises.
Yeah, and even the suits that they wear out, the cellular structure is designed to cause them to have to work against the cells that are trying to resist. And so, of course, Petro, Crater's brother, whines and complains about that all the time. He says, you know, living up here is hard enough without having to fight these cells and this patch and everything else. So he's a big complainer. But Crater still loves him.
Do you have real pets up there? Like, have people brought their dogs and cats with them?
Yeah, well, now that's very interesting. There are no animals on the moon yet with the Crater, and he doesn't know too much about animals. He's heard about them, but he doesn't really know too much about them. So when he's on the Cycler, he meets a cat. They have a ship's cat. Its name is Paco, and Paco is the name of the cat that I put in Back to the Moon. So there are some characters that were in Back to the Moon that's also in this book. And coincidentally, I just there's a Kindle single out there. If you go out to Amazon.com, you'll see where I've got another new book out, but it's only an e-book, and it's called Paco the Cat Who Meowed in Space. And Paco was a real cat. Paco had to meow in space in order to save a real space mission. And so I tell about that, and I try to put Paco in all my space books.
And people can go to, well, I'll put the URL in the archives when I write it up, but they can, if they have an ebook reader or a Kindle, they can get Paco directly, right?
Yeah, or you can download the Kindle app, and on any computer you can read Paco the Cat Who Meowed in Space. And it also tells about my early years with NASA. So it's more than just about Paco, it's really his story. But I wanted to give a little bit of background on how I came to work for NASA, what I did for NASA, a little bit about the Challenger. I knew Krista McAuliffe and most of the Challenger crew, and then I worked on the solid rocket booster redesign, so I had to study the Challenger accident in detail. So Paco, the cat who meowed in space, will tell about all that.
Did you get any assistance or guidance from anyone at NASA in terms of writing Crater, doing your research?
Well, I mean, I just know everybody out there, and the folks that knew that I was writing Crater were always volunteering. They were mostly volunteering, but I should put their name in the book. But the writing life is a bit of a solitary life, and ultimately the book has to be yours. Now, I did work with a couple of folks out there, though, that really did help me quite a bit, and I've got their acknowledgement in the back of Crater. So that was always very helpful.
Do the kids out there, or the people that you're able to talk to, I know you're signing books for Crater, but do you get a chance to tell them about the book and how some of these futuristic problems are dealt with? And I'd be interested in knowing, you know, do they know anything about it? Does this grab their attention?
It grabs their attention. Do they know anything about it? I mean, sadly, not very much. And that's one of the reasons that we created an interactive website called Helium3Novels.com, plural novel, Helium3Novels.com, that is going to be great for teachers and also homeschool teachers also. And basically what it does is allow students to explore the moon on their own. It's got a little bit about the novel in it, certainly, but most of it is about the moon, and there are various places where they can click, and different videos of the moon will come up. And one of the cool things, you know, if you read Crater and you see, okay, Crater lives up in the Alpine Valley of the moon, and you've read it, and now you want to see it, you can actually go to this site, you click on the Alpine Valley, and up will come a video that looks like a helicopter or something flying over it. You've got that kind of view of it, just swooping down the whole Alpine Valley. And then all of a sudden, that becomes meaningful to a student because they know, well, hey, that's where Crater and Petro and the Gili live.
Here's another question from you. This is Paul in Denver. And Paul said, it appears to me from what you've been talking about that you must be very supportive of the efforts that NASA is doing along with the private companies to take over transportation both for cargo and humans to low Earth orbit. Are you a strong believer that that's a good way to go and that SpaceX and the other companies will be able to handle it?
Yes, I do. I mean, of course, I love Elon Musk and what he and the Rocket Boys and Rocket Girls have done out at SpaceX with not very much. It's just amazing what they have done and their capabilities, and I'm looking forward to their first rendezvous with the space station in May. And so let's all cross our fingers and our toes that all that comes off. Now, I'm a big, great critic of NASA for not having a replacement for the space shuttle, to just shut it down and say, oh, we're going to go commercial without having any real plan. They just kind of made that up, in my opinion. There was already a commercial program going on that had to do with SpaceX and Orbital Sciences and a few of them in terms of delivering cargo to the space station. It was Elon Musk himself who came up with the idea of making that cargo carrier, the Dragon, also carry people. So this indicates the federal government, great failure in my opinion of the federal government and NASA not to have a replacement already ready to go before they shut the shuttle program down. And that's just poor management and just poor overall.
Many people want to head off to the moon and head off to Mars and have a Martian colony, and yet you've chosen a lunar colony. Is that primarily because of the potential commercial value of helium-3 as to what might be commercial on Mars is unknown?
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in Mars, but I think we're doing a great job with the Mars rovers, the robots that we have there right now. In my opinion, we don't have the infrastructure, we don't have the engines, we don't have the technology right now to send humans to the moon unless we just want to make a very uncomfortable year-long trip for them that we're not without any kind of backup or anything. So I think we need the Mars Cycler idea is a good idea, where you've got a ship that's constantly, maybe several of them, constantly going back and forth over there. That's workable. Ultimately, though, if we're going to go to Mars in an Apollo program, you need nuclear rocket engines, and we're a long way from building those. So, yeah, let's focus on what we can do right now. And to me, the moon is extremely interesting place, and it's a place where people can actually go live. It's what I call the eighth continent. It got calved off of the Earth some 4 billion years ago, so it's part of the Earth. And we've already gone there, so why not go live there? It just makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, I think a lot of people would agree with you, but everyone seems to wait for the government to have another program to take us back there. But you're not doing that at all in your books. You've given a commercial reason to go back there and do this.
Well, you know, I look at it, David, like, well, what's the incentive of any earthly government to put a colony on the moon? Now, we've got some nice research stations down in Antarctica, which is kind of similar to it, and they're basically science-oriented, and they actually spent a lot of money on the South Pole Station and some of the other places down there, and it's great. We get back a lot of science, but that's been going on since the 1950s, so that's been an ongoing program. Now, so what's the incentive, though, to go up and put a colony on the moon for government, especially when what if you start having people live up there, the next thing you know, you've got something like those 13 colonies 200 years ago or so, and they want to go independent. And so right now I don't see the governments have a lot of incentive for doing it. So let's don't wait for them. Let's go ourselves. And that's why in Crater I write in Latin. It's Luna est vestri, carpe est, which means the moon is yours, seize it. The moon does belong to all of us, and it belongs to, especially to the young people who don't lack for the imagination about going back, who don't care about all the politics involved. They just want to go because that's a natural, normal thing for them, because they're young and they can do anything.
We have another email, and this is our friend Todd in San Diego. And by the way, listeners, you can use the phone line. I know many of you are at work on the Friday morning show, but it is 1-866-687-7223. And Todd says a couple of things. Thank God for the brilliance of American entrepreneurs' ingenuity and capabilities, because just think of what SpaceX and Elon has done relative to what the government of North Korea can do with its rocket. One would hate to think that SpaceX was stuck in the same position North Korea is with development of a rocket. They're doing far more than a government. But my real comment on all of this is, do you think that there's any way that regulations or government policies might hinder the outcome that you are excited about and that you write about in the book and think might come? Are we at risk for having the ability to go there and commercialize and do things? Do we need property rights, or can we do it as prescribed under the Outer Space Treaty? And then finally, do you discount the rhetoric from China and other countries that say they want to go to the moon?
Well, what I perceive that will be 120 years in the future is that all the countries that we know today they don't exist. All the big countries have broken down into smaller countries because of the overpopulation. You just can't manage all these people. And so I love the United States. You won't find a more patriot than me. But for the purposes of my novel, I have it broken into four pieces that are still wonderful democratic democracies and have the spirit of the United States, but they basically had to reorganize themselves because they got too big. So, and some of these countries are really, they have the spirit of entrepreneurship. And so if one country won't allow you to go to the moon, another country will. And because that's real life. If the United States puts up so many regulations on Elon Musk and SpaceX, well, they'll just go somewhere else. They'll go, they'll go to Abu Dhabi. They'll go somewhere that will let them do what they are born to do. And so that's the way I see things being organized, and all of the space treaties and all that, I see that as just being scrubbed away. And we start all over again.
So the UN treaties sort of disappear into the vacuum, and the United States breaks down into four different countries?
Well, not only the United States, but all of them. China becomes about eight different countries, and they have reboots on those all the time. And so, and by the way, I think part of the question was that do I discount China going to the moon? I don't discount China going to the moon, but like the old Apollo veterans used to say, or still say, the next people who try it, they're going to find out it's a lot harder than it looks. And I think China is going to find that out, too. And the best you're going to be able to do would be to have something like the Apollo program, which ultimately was a dead end. And that's why I'm talking about scramjets, cyclers, and infrastructure that actually is set up that makes it relatively cheap and easy to go back and forth to the moon.
This is Roger, and Roger's in Cambridge. And he said, I'm studying aerospace engineering, and a lot of what I study are surface lunar habitats. You mentioned that everybody would be living 20 feet underground. Do you not think there will be surface habitats that are suitable for living on the moon?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I have that where they're starting to learn how to build domes where people can see. out, and there's observation towers as well. So they're not like moles where they're constantly underground. They do get to, I mean, to me, the moon is just a beautiful place, and of course the sky is incredible. And they're going to build places where the people are going to be able to see out and not feel like that they're constantly underground.
So there will be some structures that, and I guess over time then, that evolves more and more. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, and again, it's sort of like where I grew up in Colwood, West Virginia. When we started out, it was just all nasty little shacks, and ultimately it grew into quite the thriving little village. And so that's the way I see things evolve.
This is Tim in Chicago. And Tim says, I have two sons, age 8 and 10. I am not allowed to have them fire Estes rockets from the toy store any place within reason of where I can go. I'm just wondering if conditions of today existed back in the days when you were growing up, based on your book, Rocket Boys. Could you guys have ever done what you were doing? Would you have had your interest in rockets and aerospace? What do you think would have happened if you lived in a world where you can't even fire off an Estes rocket as a kid?
Well, I mean, that's a very good point. Of course, if we'd had Estes rockets, I'm afraid I wouldn't have ended up building a big, bad rocket, because I would have just gone out and bought a kit. So thank goodness they didn't have them. There were actually laws, FAA regulations against flying rockets at times, as we did, but we didn't know it. So, you know, sometimes you beg for forgiveness. And that's what we did. These days, it's much more constrained for kids, and I do recommend that they go ahead and join rocket clubs. They're a lot of fun, and they can learn an awful lot, and still get a lot of the thrills and chills of the Rocket Boys era.
So it's really about joining a club now and doing it in a sort of a constrained and regulated environment, rather than what you were able to do as a kid.
Well, you know, there are advantages to that. There were a lot of amateur rocket builders during my era, and there are a lot of men today walking around missing fingers and thumbs. And we were very, very safe, because we grew up in a mining community where they used a lot of dynamite and plastic caps, and so we were scared about that, so we really, really paid attention. Now, I really do recommend joining the club. They get a lot of camaraderie, and you learn an awful lot about rocketry, and that's all part of it.
When you read Crater, do you get the political infrastructure of the world you're describing? For example, is the breakup of these large countries embedded in the dialogue in Crater?
No, it's just background. I don't dwell on that too much. Because the owner of all these mining communities are independent. They don't belong to any country at all, really. So that allows the plot and the people there to be a little bit more freewheeling than they would be if we had government oversight all the time.
Christine is in St. Louis, Missouri, and says, David, I'm at work. I can't use the telephone, but I'm listening through earphones. Sorry about that. But my question is, who owns the cycler transportation and lunar transportation? For example, your show a couple weeks ago on the lunar space elevator, that was about a private company trying to do something like that. Is this transportation system that Homer envisions privately owned? You buy a ticket and off you go? Or is this NASA and government transportation?
No, it's all private, and it's actually the owner of Crater's town, Moontown, and the mine, Colonel Medeiros, who's a descendant of Jack Medeiros that I wrote about in Back to the Moon. He is a businessman par excellence. He owns a part of the lunar elevator. He owns the cycler company. He owns the moon town. He owns a lot of things. He's a very, very powerful man, which makes it interesting when he picks on little Crater to go off and get something for him, a package that he realizes is going to put Crater in great danger, but he doesn't much care, because as far as he's concerned, what's good for Medeiros Enterprises is good for the moon.
So what's good for the corporation, the big company, takes precedence over the individual.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, he's not an evil man. He has created there with Moontown a society where men and women can raise their families in peace and have good, productive jobs. So, so you know, that's the dichotomy always of our system. Sometimes corporations can do bad things, but most often they do good things. They create jobs and they cause advances in engineering and technology, and so it's all good. But you know, I'm just telling it the way it is. Now, I grew up with that. I grew up in Colwood, which is owned by a company. Everything was owned by the company. Even the church was owned by the company. We were whatever religion the company said we were going to be. But I have very fond memories of living in that pure company town, and the people of Moontown, they like it too, but they do recognize that the colonel can every once in a while get a little greedy and maybe not pay as much attention to young orphans like Prater as perhaps he should.
So is Moontown and Armstrong City, are they based on United States law and democracy, or is it no man's land like Tombstone or Dodge City? Or
it's a lot more like Tombstone. It's a Wild West situation. The Colonel Medeiros has a sheriff, and the sheriff basically enforces whatever the colonel's law is of the day. So that. To me, that was kind of interesting to set up a society like that. There's no democracy on the moon. It's basically each of the town owners or mine owners, they basically make up the rules themselves. Armstrong City is the same way. It is a town of merchants and tour operators, and they're organized, but they have a mayor, but they have no allegiance to any government on Earth.
And so I imagine anyone from any nationality on Earth can go to the moon, and they know what they're getting into to go up there.
Yeah, they come up there quite often. They change their names, and a lot of times they get nicknames. Like one of Crater's friends who lives in what they call the Dust Palace, which is. The bachelor officer quarters, if you will, in Moontown. His name is Asteroid Al, and nobody knows too much about him. That's what he calls himself. We don't know if he committed crimes on Earth or too much about him. But that's to me, that's interesting too, to have characters like that are basically starting life anew. And but sometimes their old ways come back, and so the sheriff of Moontown is forever having to break up knife fights and this kind of thing going on, because these are men are coming from a war-torn Earth, and quite often they discover that they were on opposite sides down there.
So I'm jumping to a conclusion here that there are no extradition treaties back to Earth, right?
No. If you can come up and you do good work for the colonel, or any other mine owner, you've got a job. And you can have a job as long as you don't kill anybody or hurt anybody too often. You can continue to have that job. Because mainly what they're trying to do is to meet a production schedule. They got to get that helium-3, they call it HEAL-3, they got to get that HEAL-3 to the Earth, and because people down there are desperate for that energy.
Here you have Allison in Phoenix, Arizona. David, I'm also at work, same predicament. However, ask your guest how the people on the moon get their food and water and supplies. Is everything brought up from Earth? Is there anything done in situ? Have they figured out a way to garden or grow anything?
Yeah, nothing is brought up from Earth. Everything is in situ. They've got greenhouses. With a glass dome. Glass is very easy to make on the moon. You've got a little bit of heat. And they also have BioVet. Again, I'm predicting a biological revolution, so they're able to create a variety of different foods in these BioVets. And water is, as of the first book in Crater, water is being brought down from the north, where craters are in permanently shadow, and there's water ice there that can be brought down by trucks to keep the mining communities going. However, Prater is quite the little engineer and quite the little innovator, and before the book is over, Prater has figured out actually how to find water on the moon and bring it to the surface. And one of the things that we've learned in the last few years is that the moon has a lot of water on it. The only problem is that there are a lot of water molecules that are scattered around. So how do you get it? How do you find that water, and then how do you accumulate it in a pool, and how do you pump it up? Prater comes up with an invention that allows him to do that, and that's something else I had to do a lot of research, talking to a lot of people here on Earth who find water in, you know, the desert. How do you do that? And so in the latter chapter of Prater, the last chapter of Prater, I give you a hint on how that's being done, and then I'm going to be writing more about that in the second Helium 3 novel.
Does Prater make it through all three books? Is he the main figure in all three of the books?
Well, I'm going to say yes. I'd like to say, well, give you some tension there, Prater is the main character, so I think we're going to see Prater make it through all three books, but it's going to be a growing thing for Prater. He's going to change. He's not going to be the same person at the end of the three books as he was from the get-go, and I think it's one of the important things about writing a novel. You've got to show the character. You've got to show some growth with the character.
Larry, in Salt Lake City, is there a way for people living on the moon to come back and visit Earth? Does anyone do that?
If they've got the money to do that, if they're living in Moontown, which is out in the Alpine Valley, it's 1,000 miles from Armstrong City, they could hitch a ride on one of the Helium 3 convoys if they're with an extra seat, and that's a long, dangerous journey. Then they've got to come up with the money to ride up the lunar elevator, which isn't too expensive, but the cycler itself is fairly expensive. Be like flying from New York to Japan. It's not so expensive that you couldn't afford it, but it is. It does give you pause when you see that number come up. So they'd have to get there. They'd have to first take time off from work, and everybody has a production schedule to meet, so that's hard. But yeah, the bottom line is, yes, they can go back and forth to Earth, but most of the people on the moon don't want to go there. They've left the Earth for a reason. They want no more part of it. They long for it in a way. They look up and they see this beautiful blue and white planet, and they long for it, but the moon is now their home.
Rodney is in Memphis with an email and says, David, also at work, here's my question. Today in April in 2012, our space policy seems to be in disarray, and our economy is in the tank, and the global economy is in the tank. What do you, Homer, see as having to happen in order to facilitate the world you describe in the 22nd century? And is there any kind of a timeline that would absolutely command the result that you're writing about? What is that timeline?
Well, Prater takes place in the 2020s, the 21. I'm losing track of 2120. There for a while, I was wondering, what century am I in here? But 2120.
So 110 years from now.
Yeah, that's when I'm predicting that all this will happen. What will have to happen, of course, is my timeline for the Earth governments to be breaking up and smaller governments to be created. Really entrepreneurial governments being created and so on and so forth. Who knows how it's all going to turn out? Now, with our present civilization as it is right now, certainly we need better leadership. I mean, we're $15 trillion in the hole. I don't get too political here, but we are. And that was mostly spent to stimulate the economy, and I don't know where it went, but if they had slid a little bit of that over to NASA, they didn't, actually. They cut NASA. If they had slid a few hundred billion to NASA, I mean, my gosh, the economy would have just gone crazy. And that's what happened with the Apollo program. We've had, ever since the Apollo program, with all the technologies created there, you talk about an economy stimulator, I mean, it's tremendous. And why these politicians don't understand what an economy driver that NASA is, I will never know, but they don't seem to get it. So I guess it comes down to electing better leaders that do get it.
Do you So what has to happen in terms of advancements in technology and engineering for the world you're writing about to actually have a shot at becoming real? Do we need better rockets? What do we need in order to make this all happen?
Well, the technology that I use is just a natural evolution. I am predicting this revolution in bioengineering, where we use actually living cells to do a lot of things for us, including pressure suits and growing food and this kind of thing. But in terms of rocket technology and so on, I'm not going too far for it. What I'm saying is that if we have a scramjet, a workable scramjet that would allow us to take off from a runway with passengers and cargo and scram on into orbit with a little rocket boost at the end and catch up with the cyclers that are constantly going around the Earth, this doesn't require a big revolution in technology. We should have the capabilities to do that if we just put our mind to it. And so that's the technology that Crater and the people who are living on the moon and the Earth are working with.
I know we talked about doing a one-hour program, and we're about 4 minutes from that 1 hour. If you can stay, fine. If you need to go, I'll ask you for your closing comments, your summaries. What do you want us to take away from today?
Okay. I can stay a little bit longer, and so let me just hang on here for a while.
Okay.
I'm signing books, so if I get a long line, I may have to drop off, but I really appreciate it, Dave.
Okay, so let me take a quick minute or two break, and then we'll come back, and you can stay on as long as you can do it, okay?
Okay, great. Thank
okay,
you.
So we'll be right back. Everybody stay right where you are.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. We're talking to Homer Hickam today about his new book, Crater. Crater is not about a crater on the moon. It's about a young teen who does helium-3 mining on the moon. This is the first book of a trilogy. And we have a first question to lead off, Homer. Jerry is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he said early on in the discussion today, you mentioned helium-3 as surface mining. Is surface mining another word for strip mining? Would we see the effect of strip mining on the moon through Earth-based telescopes? Are there any environmental group or regulatory actions that you think would stop strip mining on the moon?
Well, it's another word for strip mining. There's no question about it. We surface mine for coal and surface mine for a number of different minerals here on Earth. Would we ever dig up enough of the moon that you could actually see it with the naked eye? No. Could you see it with very powerful telescopes? Maybe. basically because there would be a change of color as you turned over the regolith. So you might be able to spot that. In terms of the environment of the moon, you're certainly not going to mess the environment of the moon up. It's in a vacuum, and there is no running water to pollute, and you can't pollute the atmosphere because there is no atmosphere. So that's not going to happen. So, you know, if you really want the universe to stay static without human interaction or the humans changing it at all, then yes, there could be some objection to going up and mining the moon, just like there's objection to going anywhere mining anything. But I'm a boy who grew up in a mining town, and I saw the positive aspects of that, and I saw communities created that put children through school and through college and gave men and women productive lives. And so that doesn't bother me too much. And also, I have to say that where I grew up, most of the mines are gone now, and nature has its way. And you can go into these mining communities now, and you would never even know they were there. The trees growing up through houses, and nature is a lot more powerful than we give her credit for.
Okay, and here is another one, and this is from Greg. And Greg is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he said, there have been lots of talk over the years because of the moon's lower gravity that it could be a manufacturing base for off-Earth, including, for example, a large spaceship that could go to Mars. There's also talk of beaming solar power to Earth from the moon and putting antennas for radio communications to be crystal clear on the backside. And then there have been books written about mining platinum group metals and bringing platinum group metals back to Earth. Are any of these advanced ideas part of Crater or your trilogy, or do you think they're all just science fiction?
Well, I don't think they're all science fiction. It's not particularly part of Crater, although as a byproduct of helium-3 mining, they do get platinum and a number of other minerals that they make mooncrete and they make glass and this kind of thing out of for use on the moon and on Earth. Just about anything they make on the moon is very valuable on the Earth as you know, in jewelry stores and this kind of thing. So it that whole economy that could be set up, it's just a matter of is it can you make some money off of it? And ultimately, that's what we'll find out. I mean, for instance, the coal fields of West Virginia, where I grew up, were not developed until the early 20th century. And people have been living there for, you know, over 100 years. And yet nobody saw a way of making any money there and living there. And all of a sudden, they decided, well, we need the coal. They get the coal. And I see that that's what will happen on the moon.
Do you think there will be things like manufacturing there for spaceships going to Mars or for communications on the backside, solar panels, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that it's a lot easier to get from the moon to Mars than it is out of this deep gravity well that we live on here on Earth. Of course, another way to do it is to build your ships in orbit and leave from there. That's a possibility, but you know, it's just a matter of when the time comes, when we're actually ready to go to Mars, we need to take a look at it and see what's the best way to do it. I'm just interested in creating and building a civilization on the moon. And as I said, I think it's the eighth continent. It's one that's been neglected far too long. It's 245,000 miles away. That's part of the problem. But we've been there already. We know how to get there, and let's go back. Let's build a civilization there. In terms of the backside of the moon, which is, that would be wonderful for a radio telescope that was completely outside of any earthly transmissions. It would be listening to deep space without any interference, and also just telescopes itself sitting back there. Would be able to see to the beginning of the universe, and I think certainly that is that's a resource that if we're smart, someday we're going to develop.
Okay, Becky is in Orlando, and she said, "Newt caused quite a stir during the Republican debate down here when he called for a lunar colony. Of course, he was laughed at, but this is essentially what you have in your book, Crater. Do you think Newt was just premature? Do you think we're really ready to understand the potential for a lunar colony?
Well, again, I mean, when Newt came up with that idea, I love him to death, but he got ridiculed, and just about it, and you know, all the other politicians ran for cover. They weren't about to make such a grand gesture toward space. And it, to me, that's very, very strange. And I know it is to you, David, and all of us who love space. We can't understand why anybody would make fun of living in space. Excuse me. It just seems to us natural and normal thing for humankind to do. So I'm sorry that he did get ridiculed, but I hope that whoever the next president and beyond will see that in order to really make our economy grow again and also give our youth some hope for the future, we need to go back to the moon and create a civilization there. Again, that's why I write Luna Est Vestri Carpe Diem. The moon is yours. Seize it. It belongs to all of us, and we should be up there.
Yeah, I didn't think Newt did a very good job of talking about it, but the running for cover by every single other candidate was mind-boggling. And that idiotic question, that comment that Romney made, where if somebody brought him a lunar investment deal, he'd fire him on the spot. What total BS is that? He'd probably at least do the basic analysis to see if he could make money on the damn thing.
Well, I agree. I mean, and nothing against Governor Romney. I think he would make a great president, but any president would be great if they can see past the political mindset right now that says space is not important. It's just idiotic. In the first place, space is a billion-dollar industry, not human space flight, but commercial space flight. Our communication satellites, weather satellites, so on and so forth, our GPS satellites, to our economy are worth billions every year. So that infrastructure, that economy is there. And what we're talking about is extending the benefits of the economy to human space flight as well. And the politicians just can't seem to wrap their mind around it, whether it's President Obama, Governor Romney, or anybody else. And I salute Newt Gingrich for having the courage to come out and say, hey, this is something I'm going to do. Because what he sees, he's a writer, too. He goes out and he talks to students and so on. And what he sees is that a lot of the students, a lot of the young people, are very demoralized in our country because we're not doing great things. In order to be a great country, you have to do great things, and you want to live in a great country. And one of the great things that we can do is lead the way into space. And I just don't understand why any of these politicians, any of these leaders don't get that.
Well, we're leading the way to bankruptcy behind Greece. What can I say? That's how we're leading at the moment.
Well, the only way that we're going to get out of this is to grow out of it. And to grow out of it, we've got to go toward a space economy. There's no question in my mind about it. I mean, I'm a child of the 1950s, and I remember when the Russians launched Sputnik. All of a sudden, all these politicians who were making fun of satellites and living in space and all that kind of thing, suddenly they were just like huge space boosters. I've been saying this all along, they said, every one of them. And you see our economy crash down around our ears while everybody else is going out in space and making a lot of money. All of a sudden, they're going to see that, too. I hope we don't have to go that far. I hope that Elon Musk and a lot of the real leaders in this country will stand up and say, it's not only going into space, it's just doing everything. We need to project outward as a country. We need to start thinking big. We need to start thinking about doing great things. And, of course, one of the greatest things and most visual things is sending Americans into space and onto the moon and giving the young people some hope that this is the country on the move again, and it will. You just watch us grow right out of this problem.
Elizabeth in Houston sent in a note and says, David, I'm at JSC, can't use the phone. I'm at work, but here's my question. For Moontown as well as Armstrong City, are there hospitals? Has Homer solved how to do surgery, treat illnesses like heart attacks, et cetera, or do people get sent back to Earth, or do they just die?
In Crater, when Crater is born, there's just a little clinic there, and people do die, and they haven't really figured out how to do things. But by the time Crater is a teenager, they have this revolution in biological science. So we don't have to do surgery too much anymore. It's a matter of injecting cells into the body that are able to go and repair the heart and repair the lungs and do the repairs that's required. Now, out in the field, that's another story, and I tell the story of the gillie being my sentient clump of slime mold cells that is capable of quite some interesting things, where one of the miners is shot by a electric gun or an electric rifle, and a flechette goes into its lungs. And the gillie has to actually, Crater doesn't realize the gillie knows how to do this, but the gillie actually goes down the mouth of this fella, up through his helmet, down his mouth, and into his lungs, and comes back with the flechette, which is kind of a crude surgery, but he saves the life there.
Interesting.
Well, you know, you have to have imagination sometime to write these things, and I really think, you know, if you want to make a biological computer, slime mold cells is a good place to start.
And they're here on Earth? Do we have slime mold cells on Earth?
Yeah, we do. As a matter of fact, go out there and Google or Yahoo or whatever, slime mold, and you will be reading about a most remarkable community of cells that seems at times to have intelligence. They're able to figure out mazes and are able to configure themselves in shapes and different shapes in order to reach food. I work with the Museum of Rockies in Montana. I'm on the board there, and I've talked to some of the biologists out there who are just fascinated with slime mold and what might be able to be done with it eventually.
We're a quarter after. How's your time doing?
Well, I've got a little line here, David, so I guess I'm going to have to wrap it up.
Okay. You want to give us points to remember, takeaway points, closing comments?
Well, first off, I want to thank you, David, for this show. Dr. Space, you are doing a wonderful job for the space community and for our country, and I am, for one, I'm very appreciative for what you're doing.
Thank you.
I appreciate you having me on today to talk about Crater. And folks can go out to my website, homerhickam.com, and there you can see what essentially is a movie trailer, a preview of Crater, which is kind of exciting for kids to see, and also where they can, should be in most of the bookstores, but they can also go online and so on to get it. And then they can just look around homerhickam.com a little bit. But the main thing, the reason I wrote Crater is that I have this huge community of young people out there who love Rocket Boys and the movie October Sky, and I want them to continue to read, and I want them to, for their whole life, to enjoy reading. And if I can hook them in with Crater and also at the same time not only get them reading, but also to be thinking about the real possibilities of what it would be like to live in space and on the moon, then I've kind of done my job, just like you're doing your job out there. And again, I'm so appreciative of your program, and so appreciative to the folks who called in or emailed in with questions. They were wonderful questions. You just could have contacted us on homerhickam.com, and we answer all our email, and we love to get questions from folks and comments from folks. So feel free to go out there and get in contact with us. I'd love to hear from you.
Will do, and we'll look forward to talking to you again when part two comes out, okay?
Okay, David, I appreciate it, or anytime, on anything.
Okay, thanks a lot. And
you bet.
Listeners, that's it for today, and special thanks to Homer Hickam for being with us. And again, back on Sunday, Chris Impey will be with us on his latest book. Check the newsletter for details. Thanks again. Goodbye from The Space Show.